So let's just get started in the course. So this course, the framework of it is, for this time, is just to do an introduction. Okay. So why do apologetics? What is apologetics? Is it just for people who have PhDs in philosophy that should be doing this? And the obvious answer to that is no. One of the things that I've had the privilege of doing, that the Lord's actually given me the opportunity, and some days that seems like a privilege and some days not, is to teach. And it's to teach a particular group of individuals. And that group of individuals that the Lord has allowed me to teach are 11th and 12th graders, which can be a challenge sometimes, because how do you teach someone who seemingly knows everything, or think they know everything, right? But what I found out is that these students, particularly during their 11th grade year, are quite remarkable, because it's at that point that they're starting to ask really fundamental questions. Fundamental questions about their faith, whether they do believe. Why should I believe? This is something that my parents thought. Do I believe that anymore? And we now know that those worldviews are not actually solidified so much in college, that that's actually being pushed back further into earlier years. And for some reason, the 11th grade year is a seminal year for a lot of students to kind of ask these questions as well. So I just mentioned to you that a word, so I'm going to give you some words, and sometimes I'll write these on the board, sometimes not, but so just as far as the introduction part of it, I've used a term already called a worldview, okay? And in the culture that we live in today, there are competing worldviews, and there are a lot of them. So if I were to stop here for a second, and if I were to ask you, what is a worldview? But what would you say to me? What's a worldview? This is from a German word. I'll forego the German. But the Germans have this unique way of kind of framing words, and this word comes from that. What is a worldview? Does anyone know? Take a guess.
It's the lens through which you filter everything.
That's exactly right. It's a good way to frame that. So I'm dependent upon glasses, right? So it's the lens in which, borrow your term, it's the lens in which I see the world, okay? Everyone in here has a worldview. And what's interesting about it is that for some people, there is a kind of a mixture, kind of a picking of worldviews. What we want to do is to make sure that, is our worldview consistent? Yes, is it biblical? But you and I both know that there are a lot of people in this world who don't hold to a biblical worldview. So a worldview answers things like this. Who is God? What is God? Is there a God? It'll answer questions like this. And this is where you have to really want to be consistent with it. So let me throw a big word at you. What is the epistemology? Now, that's a huge word. But if you boil that word down, it means simply this. How do we know something? How do we know that for sure? And that's the big argument in philosophical history, is what is the means of knowing? And are we consistent in that? And I'll argue with you in a good way through this course that most worldviews are not consistent in that. And I'll give you actually an example of that this morning. Ethics. What is right and wrong? is there a right and wrong? And that is a seminal question today in our culture that will get pushed a lot. How do you know that? How can you tell me? You can't tell me oughtness. You can't tell me what I ought to do, what I ought not to do. That becomes important as well. Anthropology. What does that mean? Well, anthropology is the study, anthropos, the study of man. Okay, where did we come from, and where are we going? Are we here because we are, to borrow one theologian's term, are we here because we're grown-up germs? That we're here just here by accident? That we're just the sum total of all the kind of chemicals that are bouncing around in our heads that's firing? Or are we actually made in God's image, and that we're actually here for a purpose, and we're actually distinct among all the other types of creation that there is? So those are really important questions. Those are worldview questions. And while we won't have time because of the class is not long enough to do that, those are some of the things that we'll kind of touch on as we get through this. So let me throw this at you today before I get into some kind of illustrations, kind of get you thinking through this. We just mentioned to you the idea of worldviews. Well, there's a dominant worldview today. There are many of them that are out there. But I would argue that there's one dominant worldview that's really captured our culture today, and this is worldwide. That's so dominant that sometimes it's hard to recognize these worldviews. So I'm a type of person who likes to think by drawing things. I'm a terrible drawer. My wife's an architect. She's perfect at this. I'm not, but I like to think through these things. So the dominant worldview today is a worldview called naturalism. And the ism part, when you tag on the word ism, the suffix to a word, that it becomes the philosophy of something. Okay, so naturalism. And if I could draw this dominant worldview today, and I would encourage you to do this in your own notes as well, is to draw a box. And the reason I draw this box is because this worldview has a particular idea that goes with it. Actually, it has a lot of ideas that go with it. The dominant idea of naturalism, or materialistic naturalism, is this. So one of the first components of it is that it's a closed system. There's nothing outside the system. That all there is nature. There's no supra-nature. We know supra-nature for what other word? Supernatural. Yeah, there's no above nature. There's only nature. There's only the natural world. There's only the material of this world. And guess what's outside this box? You can guess on this one. What will be outside the box? If everything's in the box, all the natural laws, all matter, all energy, everything that you see, this building, everything that's in existence is in this box according to this worldview. Guess what's outside the box? Nothing. Which is a no thing, right? There's nothing outside this box according to this worldview. So there is no God. And because of that, there's all kinds of implications with that. So we see this worldview actually pretty early on in human history. This is not a new occurrence, but it's really taken hold in the last century or so. This idea really took hold in the 19th century. And what we're seeing in today's culture in the 21st century are some kind of outflows of that. We are steeped in this, in this culture. So some qualifications of that. So this worldview holds that there absolutely is no God. There's nothing outside. There's no transcendent being outside this box. There's no God. There's no such thing as absolutes in that sense. There's only particular things. There's no absolute truth, for example. There's only particular truths. And we'll get to that in a second. There would be nothing else outside this box that would influence anything else within this box. In other words, everything that we know, everything that we can explain from this worldview happens within this box. This is why the 19th century is so fascinating, because you have a lot of ideas that are converging in the 19th century. And the dominant person, like if we threw out some names, some of you might recognize, this person you would absolutely recognize. Charles Darwin is the kind of epitome of this in the 19th century. If you've ever read Darwin, he's kind of hard to read. He's kind of dense, but he's kind of hard to read. But Darwin is classic of this, right? So his argument, his basic premise, is that everything can be defined within the system. And in particular, the anthropos, man. That man can be defined within the system. And that we don't need an external God who breathed life into us to tell us that that's the ultimate answer to that. So this was easily for them to try to be done away with. We're seeing kind of that today. We're seeing that a lot today. These are the competing ideas today. So that's just sort of an introduction to this. You'll see me come back to this box quite a bit in the next couple of sessions as well. I want to pause here and say this before I move on. It's always good to kind of give implications when you teach something. It's always good to kind of give implications to things. I think a really good implication of this, kind of like a push this up front, is this. I'm really glad, obviously, that you're in here. I'm very encouraged to see all of you in here. What I'm most encouraged to see is actually a lot of young people that are in here. And one of the first things that Stephen told me was this: be aware of your audience when you teach this class, because I got people in here in junior high, and I got people in here who are not in junior high, right? There's this range, this spectrum of things. in the box. But it's so important because, yeah, you may have kids, you may be having kids, you may have grandchildren, you may have people, and you have young people in your lives in some way. You are a young person. And the reason I push that up front is this. The reason that we would want to think about these things and study apologetics, yes, is to glorify God. That's the primary means of that. But on kind of a tertiary, secondary level to that is because your kids are in a world where, you notice I used the word competing worldviews? Well, your kids are in a world where their minds are being competed against with other worldviews. So the things that you've taught them are the things that they're going to bump into where that's going to be challenged. And sometimes kids get into universities, and I've seen this. They've grown up in church their whole lives. They've been taught the Bible, and they get into a situation where they have a professor who has a couple of PhDs after their name. And they tell them the exact opposite of these things. And then they don't know what to do with it. They feel like the world's kind of been pulled out from underneath them. This class, these ideas are for you. For you if you're that age, and for the rest of you who have young people in your life. You need to be helping them think through these things as well. So with that in mind, let me jump into it by saying this. So I'm still in the introduction part. I like introductions. I had a former student of mine back in April send me a text. Actually, it wasn't a text. It was a message on Twitter. Now, you may not like Twitter. You may not know what that is. But the social media forum where I was. So the student contacted me. I was at school one day, and the student contacted me. Now, she's graduated now 2 years. Okay, she's a great student, excellent student, and she was in a. So you can see this on your introduction. I gave a quote at the top. She was in a communication research class. Okay? And she took a picture. That's why you have to be careful when you teach, right? Because you're that close to being a YouTube sensation if you do something stupid in teaching. So she's sitting in the back of the class, and she took out her phone, and she snapped this picture, and she sent it to me. So the picture is this. There's a screen up at the front of the class, and the professor has put up a question. Actually, it's not a question. It's a statement. And took a poll of the class. So I gave you the quote, so you should see it there in your handout as well. And the quote is this, there is an absolute truth, okay? And then the professor, which I thought about doing this morning, and I just, I'm not going to do it, but took a poll of the whole room and had the students answer, which I thought was really interesting, answer the question or respond to the statement, there is an absolute truth. So they had two options. They could have said it's A, false, or B, it's true. How would you have, just think through that in your head for a second, how would you have answered that question? There is an absolute truth. A, it's false. B, it's true. Okay? Well, she gave me, I'm in between classes. She's in class. She's tweeting me the stuff. So I'm tweeting back to her. I'm asking her some questions about this. So she's giving me more information. She said that 72% said it's false, and that 28% said it's true. She answered that. Now, what was funny to me, and I chuckled a little bit when I was going back and forth with her on this. What was funny to me is not necessarily that statement, there is an absolute truth, or that professor would take that kind of poll. What was funny to me is that the professor gave them some instant feedback to this, and here's the feedback. everyone who answered that particular answer was wrong. So let's just think through that for a second. Let's settle in on you for a second. Now, why would that be kind of an odd statement to make? That would be wrong. If you answered true, there is an absolute truth that you were actually wrong. Yeah. So what you've done, and we've all kind of played armchair philosopher this a little bit, but what's surprising to me, this professor, whom I assume is very brilliant, very bright, and I'm not dogging that at all, and it's easy to set up straw men in these kind of arguments because that professor's not here to defend himself or herself, but we've got some problems here really quick, and the student knew that, which is what I was really happy with, that realized that this is craziness, right? So first of all, you can't have a right or wrong answer. So let me give you some. Can you think of some other things? By the way, I put the word communication research up there. Now, this was a statistical class, which I'm not great with numbers. But what the professor was trying to do, in all fairness to the professor, was to say this. We do studies on individual cultures. Okay? And individual cultures get individual numbers that apply to those cultures. So not all the numbers are the same for that. I get that. But what the professor is kind of mixing up a little bit is the idea of being relative versus relativism. There's the ism. Okay. So let me give you a little bit of a difference really quick, and then we'll kind of take this apart a little bit more. So Brad's in here. So Brad's tall. That's a statement, right? Now, that's actually a relative statement. Because Brad's tall compared, perhaps, to me. I'm not quite as tall as Brad. But if we put Brad up beside LeBron James, Brad's not tall anymore. LeBron James is huge, right? He's not just tall, he's massive, right? That's a relative statement, and we all get that. We make those kind of statements all the time, and we understand that. But what that professor's doing is transcending that idea of being relative when it's comparing numbers to moving to something else entirely. And it's moving into, yes, a philosophy. Can you see anything else that might be odd here? So, first of all, you can't have a true, you can't have, that's odd set up there, and you can't have a right or wrong. There's the first thing that goes out the window. Anything else you might see that would be odd about this? It's a communications research class. Brad. Yes.
So that seems inconsistent. You sort of need a C, can't know or don't know,
or how do you know?
Or how do you know? There's an epistemological question, right? How do you know that?
Yeah, and I think a lot of people, depending on what the question is, would want to say C in today's culture, especially as it relates to ethical issues.
Yes, yes. Yeah. So relativism has two parts to it. I didn't mention this. Relativism has what's called an epistemological relativism. That is a huge word, I know. But that's what we have here. Epistemological relativism is this. Knowledge is not, there's no absolute to it. It's all individualized. Your truth is your truth. My truth is my truth. You got that. Then there's ethical relativism as well, where morals come into this. So your moral, you have one moral, I have another. You have one ethic, which I don't have time to get into today, between the ethics, between the difference between ethics and morals is a good question to look at. But we have all that is going on as well. Anybody else see something odd about this?
The word always.
How so?
Well, that's an absolute in itself.
That's an absolute in itself, yes. And this professor, which is interesting, she didn't set this up, or he didn't set this up as a question, but as a statement.
There's an assumption that there is no God who does know the absolute truth.
Yeah, there's no standard. Notice the example I gave with Brad. We had to have a standard, right? So Brad's tall. Well, compared to what? Compared to me, he's tall. Compared to LeBron James, not so tall.
Compared to all the Italians?
Grazie. So, some things that I tweeted back and forth to this student. I was being a bit facetious here, but I think it was kind of funny. So, for example, if there's no absolute truth, then my student could not have given a wrong answer. We've established that already. Okay? If there's not an absolute truth, think about this one. So I try to put this from a teaching perspective. But there's no absolute truth, and the teacher couldn't teach anything because all views would be equal. And if all views are equal, the student's belief, what they believe, is as good as anything that teacher could have taught. Now, I said that really fast. Let me say it another way. My belief as a student in that class would be as equally valid as anything that that teacher would say. So she couldn't really teach, or he couldn't really teach me anything new, per se. Me being more facetious here, I told the student, don't worry about studying for the test. Why? Don't worry about this. Just don't worry about... Why would I say that? Don't worry about studying for the test.
There's no truth, there's no standard to grade.
Yeah, so if there must be some kind of standard. Otherwise, this teacher would not have assigned any kind of grade to that. And we've got a problem. If there's no absolute truth... Now, I've been harping on this a little bit. We've got a problem with communication, too. Why?
There's no specific meaning for each word.
There's no specific meaning for each word that's used. So underneath this all is a law of logic. So here we go, right? And it is a foundational law of logic. And it's called the law of non-contradiction. Have you ever heard of this? Anybody give a definition of this? What is the law of non-contradiction? Yes.
Two statements that are contradictory that say opposite things cannot be true at the same time.
Yeah, it's the exclusion part. So a kind of a technical way to say it is this. Something, an object, cannot be A and non-A at the same time and in the same relationship. Something or an object can't be A and non-A at the same time in the same relationship. What does that mean? Let me give you an example. What if I said to you, this is a marker and it's not a marker? What would you think of that statement? This is a marker and it's not a marker. You'd think I was crazy. That's exactly right. I was raised in the north central part of the state. I was raised on a small farm in the middle of nowhere. And one of the first things that caught my attention about apologetics is not the fact that you have to be super smart to understand this, because you don't, because I'm doing this. You don't have to be that smart. What it actually relies upon is a lot of common sense. And I grew up around a lot of people, a lot of farmers that had a lot of common sense. And if you said something like that to them, that's a plow and not a plow at the same time, they'd say, you've lost your mind. You're crazy. That makes no sense. You've done lost it. That's what it would say, right? Yeah, you can't say something like that. This is underneath our thinking what God has placed in our heads. This law, these are the functioning things. Some people I get are not friendly to philosophy, and I understand that. But one philosopher in particular, known as the philosopher, Aristotle, said this, that the laws of logic, the law of non-contradiction, is what he called the organon, the instrument by which we think. It doesn't tell us what to think. It actually tells us how to think. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a communication class. And if you do away with the law of non-contradiction, the law of logic, that teacher, I can't communicate anything to you fully. Because what I just said to you is a nonsense statement. And if I say to you, there's no such thing as an absolute. There's no such thing as this pen or this marker is both. I could just argue that to you. This marker is a marker and it's not a marker at the same time, the same relationship. That's craziness. And I've communicated craziness to you. Underneath communication are these laws. We see them functioning fully all the time. You can't live your life without these laws. That's what's so staggering about this. I would argue this, to be a true relativist, one person put it this way, you can't be a true relativist in this culture. No one's ever been a true relativist consistently. Remember back to those worldview things. Is it consistent? You can't be a true relativist, even though people claim this all the time, and live consistently in this world. It's always forced. Relativism is always forced, and it's always temporary. It's always forced, and it's always temporary. So let me give you an illustration really fast. We can move on. If I were driving down College Avenue, okay, and I came to this massive intersection. So let me give you one that most of you probably are aware of. So if I came to this huge intersection of College Avenue and Joyce, okay, the mall, the Northwest Arkansas Mall is up here. Okay, I'm going north on College. Okay, let me give you an example why relativism is always forced and it's always temporary. Even though we live in a culture, this professor would affirm that as well. So I'm going north on College Avenue. I'm headed north, and all of a sudden, I want to turn left. I want to turn left onto Joyce. Now, before I do that, I notice that barreling down College Avenue going south is a Tyson chicken truck. Massive. Chicken feathers flying everywhere. Right? We've all seen this. Chicken feathers flying everywhere. And I want to turn left. Now, in my schema, in my relativistic scheme of things, I could say, before I turn left in front of the Tyson chicken truck, you know, there's no absolute truth. I really don't believe that to be true. Now, it may be true for the truck driver, but that's not true for me. I'm going to turn left. And so I wait till the truck comes, gets closer and closer and closer. I zip out into the middle of College Avenue, which is a huge, everybody runs that light anyway. Have you seen that? So I run the light anyway, I zip in front of it, and the truck comes along and hits me. Now, that's a stupid example. It's a silly example, right? But I mention this because, once again, to be a true relativist is both forced, I force that issue, and it's temporary. I'm going to die if I'm a true relativist in that sense. It does not work. Now, these sound like really simple things, but this is where we're at in this culture. And while people say this, that there are no absolutes, they've made, as someone said in the back, they've made these kind of absolute statements as well. There's a famous writer, I teach, one of some other things I teach is literature. One is a famous writer, Fyodor Dostoevsky. Dostoevsky is a Russian writer. wrote The Underground Man, The Brothers Karamazov, these great novels. And Dostoevsky was attributed to making the statement that if there is no God, then all things are permissible. If there is no God, and Dostoevsky's coming at this from a Christian perspective or a theistic perspective, if there is no God, then all things are permissible. So what does he mean by that? Well, he means that in the sense if there's nothing outside the box, then there is no standard. And you can pretty much, and people do, right? You can pretty much make an argument to do anything that you want to do because you can't tell me what I should do or not do. If you remove the ultimate standard, an absolute, capital A, if you remove the absolute standard, this is the world that we live in today, that you can argue that you can pretty much do what you want to do. As a matter of fact, in this culture today, we run up against a couple of terms, two of them that you know pretty well, and one of them that's really kind of come onto the scene that are challenging all these things that I've talked about. So one of them is called agnosticism. You see that on your introduction to being agnostic, agnosis, without knowledge. So people make this argument that they just don't know because they don't know if there's a God or not because there's just not enough information. Bertrand Russell is a famous philosopher who made that argument. Didn't know if there's enough information. There's the atheistic person, the atheist, right? Which you've heard that term. And that's someone who what? Who what? That does not, claim they don't believe in God. I'm going to make an argument later, which I've made this with, and you've probably known people who claim to be atheists in your life. I've had several students who've claimed this, and we've kind of talked through these things. And I usually make a statement which they don't generally like, but I always like to kind of play my cards on the table up front, and I'll tell them, I don't really think you're an atheist at all. And the reason I say that is because Paul actually tells us in Romans 1, there are no such thing as atheists. We all know there's a God. We just don't like him. We actually hate him. And we'll do everything we can to kind of push that knowledge out. We'll suppress that knowledge. We know this already, clearly. And so one of the things we'll look at next week is the kind of that model that Paul uses, that we clearly know that. So there's the agnostic, there's the atheist, and then there's this new kind of term that's come onto the scene by people like Richard Dawkins, who has written several polemical books, several books that are really out there. So this is a group called, and I'll write it on the board here. So we have agnosticism, we have atheism, and then we have this term, which I like to term anti-theism. Now, theism is belief in God, right? All Christians are theists, not all theists are Christians. Okay, so we can unpack that later. But there's this term called anti-theism. Okay, and people like Richard Dawkins, who is a zoologist, he's got a PhD, taught at Cambridge, writes these books and goes on these lecture tours who argue this. They want to get rid of the whole idea. They think the idea of God is not only immoral, which is kind of a funny word for them to use, but it's actually dangerous. And so people like Christopher Hitchens, who's actually passed away in the last few years, who's probably the most interesting of these guys, would argue that a belief in God is actually a dangerous thing. And if you're a young person sitting in here, they would argue that your parents, by teaching you that there is a God, Dawkins has made this argument, that that's actually a form of child abuse. They hold nothing back. They're very bold in this proclamation. One of the newest members of this group, and I didn't bring the book, I'll bring it in next time to show you the book, is a guy by the name of Lawrence Krauss, who is a theoretical physicist. He works in California, but he has gone on tour a lot with Richard Dawkins as well. Dawkins' main argument is this. One of his main books is called The God Delusion. And he argues that if you believe in God, you are dangerous, you are immoral, or you're crazy. So take your pick. And he kind of clumped you and I together kind of in all those categories. And if you believe in God, you are deluded. You're delusional. And they argue that all wars and all pestilence and everything, they blame everything on the belief in God. And so they do everything they can to kind of eradicate that whole notion as well. So that's a big introduction, I know. So let me give you like a little statement. I'll pause here for a question or two. The last statement I put on the introduction is this. So what are we doing? I've just given you kind of it seems all really bad news, right? All this kind of snapshot stuff of what's going on a little bit in our culture. So why are we in here? What are we doing? What is apologetics? What's the role of it? And I put on here in this handout for you, this, in the introduction part, that the role of apologetics, and I'll define it in a second what it is to help Christians to know what they believe, why they believe it, and how to defend that. So what do you do when you get people standing up and say, I think your ideas are dangerous, I think you're a danger to society, I don't think there's truth. How do you address these kind of things? And while we can't do everything in here, I hope this is going to get you start thinking in that and then give you some good resources to kind of help you start thinking through that. I'll stop here. Any questions you have before I know I need to move on in this, but let me do some other things really fast, and we'll get through this. So point number two in this. So what is apologetics? What is a Christian apologist? Simply this. And we can get all kind of the technical terms and all this we want, but the purpose of the class is apologetics. So what is apologetics? Well, it's to give a defense for the Christian truth claims. So that word apology is not new, right? That's just a Greek word from the Greek word apologia. So, for example, if you've ever read Plato's Apology, so it's the apology, it's the trial of Socrates, right? This is the title of it, the apology. It's the defense. Socrates is making a defense claim. And so we see that clearly. We also see it in the scriptures as well. So I'll have you mark this. I think I put this in your handout. Primarily, we see this in 1 Peter. 1 Peter, is a, Brad preached through this several months ago. It's a really fascinating book to go through. But I know you're very familiar with this passage, but 1 Peter chapter 3, 14 through 16, Peter says this. He says, "But even if you should suffer for righteousness' sake, you will be blessed. Have no fear of them, nor be troubled, but in your hearts honor Christ the Lord as holy, and always be prepared to make a defense," make an apologia to defend, "to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that's in you." And then I like to highlight this part, because we oftentimes people go to that verse who like apologetics, and they read that part where it says make a defense, and you're like, yeah, I'm ready for that, right? But they leave off the other part of it, which says what? To make a defense, and yet to do it with gentleness and respect. To do it with humility. Sometimes the best apologetic, because you're going to get really crazy questions. Your kids will get really crazy questions. I get really crazy questions. And sometimes the best apologetic is to say this. That's a really good question, and I don't know the answer to that question. But how about you and I trying to figure that out together, and let's try to reason through that. Instead of trying to win an argument, you're actually trying to win a heart in that. I think that's the kind of a key thing to remember in all this. So for those of you who like to be intellectual and try to win arguments, that's not really what Peter's after here. It's actually to win other people, not to try to win arguments.
Hey, Chris.
Yes?
When I hear the word apology, though, I don't think of defense. I think of expressing remorse for something. So.
Yeah. So sometimes in our culture, too, the word apology comes across as meaning I'm sorry.
Right.
Yeah. It's a good, really good point to make. And in our terms, that's what that means. But in the classic meaning of that word, that's actually not what it means. And there's actually two parts to it. There's a defense, so to make a defense, an apologia, to defend, so you're on defense. But there's also an offensive way of looking at it, too. So apologetics is not just, okay, I'm taking on all these questions. But and also, it turns things around to ask questions of other people. Like, I have a student who just graduated. Over 2 years, he's claimed to be agnostic, then atheist, then agnostic. He kind of shuffles back and forth. And he and I have had this ongoing conversation, both written and oral. And one part of it, he wants to ask me a lot of questions. But at some point, I in turn, kindly and respectfully, want to turn that around and say, well, you've asked me questions. Let me ask you a question. What do you do with your guilt if there's no God? Is there such thing as guilt? What do you do with it? And that's kind of a setup question because he and I both know he has guilt. He's guilty of something. I am too. What do you do with it? So, yeah, in our culture, it seems like to say, hey, I'm sorry, but it's actually quite, it's the opposite of that, isn't it? It's not to say you're sorry. It's actually to defend why, to give a reason for why you believe. Ladies and gentlemen, the Christian faith is not where you lose your mind. This is actually being rational. I just told you that's craziness. Where you make statements and you say you're false, that's irrationality. And I'm not arguing for rationalism. There's the ism again. I'm arguing to be rational. And that the Christian faith, underneath it all, is built not on a concept. It actually is built on a person. And that person is the risen Christ, who actually did come, did live. We know this empirically. This is why Paul says we don't preach vain myths. We actually preach the person of whom we saw, talked, touched, is in a person. So that, I think, becomes really important in this. This all can sound rather intimidating, I know. But this is the point of doing apologetics, is to engage these things. So number three, really quick. Is there a difference between apologetics? So apologetics is giving a defense claim for the reason of the hope that's in you. Is there a difference between apologetics and evangelism? So I'll have you engage with me on this. And what do you think it is? Is there a difference? Is it the same? What do you think? If you get the answer wrong, We're all dead in 100 years, so it doesn't matter. Right? It's comforting. Yes?
I mean, in apologetics, it's possible that all you do is put out positively what you believe. But in evangelism, you're doing that and calling for a response.
Yeah.
Calling for that person to respond to what you said.
Right.
With a particular call to Christ, to repent and believe.
That's right.
Gospel.
Yeah. Gospel, yeah. Which all of you are very familiar with, right? What is the knowing the gospel is what's so important. Yeah, there is obviously, as Brett said, there's a distinction between the two. And yet we see in the scriptures sometimes, and Paul's a really great example of this. We'll take a look at this. He intertwines these things. They're not separate. There's that old adage that's kind of the two sides of the same coin. They're used. Apologetics is used as a defense, yes, but not to defend a concept. It's actually to get to a person. It's getting to the risen Christ. And so apologetics and evangelism become really important. I like the way R.C. uses the term pre-evangelism. Apologetics are pre-evangelism. And I think that's a good way to think about that. Now, we live, you know this, in church where we've talked about what comes out of the 16th century of what's meant by saving faith, right? And there's three compartments to that, right? So saving faith is the first one is what's called the notitia, right? Which is the data. This is the content of the gospel, right? Gospel is subjective, objective. It's the content of it. Underneath that is what's called the assensus, right? Which is the assent or the acknowledgement or belief. I know you've heard that before, that James makes this argument, even the demons believe, they tremble, but they don't have saving faith. So I introduce this concept to my students a lot of times who've never heard this before. And I'll say, what is saving faith? So I'll go through this and I'll say, if I brought Jesus into the room, if you've never met Jesus before, and I brought him into the room, had him in the back, he came out, and I said, this is Jesus. Does that save you? And they'll say, well, no, that doesn't save you. I say, okay, that's the data. That's the content, right? I've introduced you to Jesus. It doesn't save you. But what if I said, this is Jesus, the Son of God? Does that save you? And then some of them are like, I don't know, maybe. And then others are like, I don't know. I don't think so. And then I say to them that passage from James. Well, James says, even the demons believe that's Jesus. They give an assensus. They assent to that intellectually. But that's not saving faith. Apologetics is great at the content and maybe getting someone to the assensus part. It's the argument. It's the defense of that. What it cannot do, you know this, I know this, R.C. Sproul knows this, John Calvin makes this argument. He makes the argument between proof and persuasion. You don't want to offer persuasion to people. You can't persuade people. You want to offer proof to people. What's the difference? If I persuade you something, in 10 minutes, someone who's a whole lot smarter than I'll ever be will unpersuade you. You're after proof. But proof doesn't save people. What's the other part of this? What's the third part of this?
Trust.
Alliance. Affection. I can trust something and not love it. This is loving the Lord, trusting the Lord. I can't make you do that. No evangelism, no apologetic can get you to do that. Only God the Spirit, the Holy Spirit, changes someone's heart. Yes, we'll take the things of the arguments and change them. That's the work of the Spirit that does that. And I can't make somebody believe. That's why you're not born, and I'm not born a Christian. Born Christians. I've heard people make that argument. Well, no, you're not. You may like things about Christianity. I can't reborn somebody. I can't rebirth somebody. That's the work of the Spirit. And so, yeah, this is a classic distinction between that. So apologetics, once again, what's the difference? Well, apologetics is the defending of that truth. Evangelism is the telling of this good news of who Christ is. God, man, Christ response. You've heard that before. Number four in your outline. I'll stop here. Questions on that? I went through that a little fast. Did you know what I meant by when I said the gospel is subjective and objective? Because I just kind of threw that out there, and it may not make any sense to you. Do you know what I mean by that? No? Okay. The gospel is objective, meaning this. The objective part of the gospel is, here's the facts about Jesus. Here's Jesus, he's the Son of God. He came to die on your behalf, on the behalf of sinners. If you place your trust in him, if you trust in him and his good works alone, not yours, you'll be saved. That is the objective news of the gospel that goes out to all who hear it. The subjective part of it is this. What do you do with that individually as a subject? Do you reject that? Do you accept that? Do you repent and believe in that? So objective nature of the gospel, subjective nature. And apologetics fits into that of looking through the ideas of the objective part of that. So, for example, before I can call upon Christ as my Savior, I have to understand who Christ is. That might be a fundamental question that people ask. I need to know that I need a Savior. A lot of people believe in God, they say, but they reject the fact they would need a Savior. I have to understand that I'm a sinner, which presupposes a question. Well, what does it mean to be a sinner? What is sin? What if I don't believe I'm a sinner? Back to that worldview again. My anthropos, my ethics. I don't believe that I'm a bad person, which you hear a lot of people say. Actually, I do believe I'm a bad person. But people will argue that, right? So that's an apologetic. We have to understand that God exists, yes, and that I'm alienated from him in my sin. This is the content of the gospel. So we see that. So apologetics is defending the truth. Evangelism is telling of this good news, kind of quite simply. Okay, last part, really fast. This is number four in your handout. I get bogged down in handouts sometimes because people like do 14 subpoints to the fourth subpoint, and then I get lost taking notes. So. But this is number four. It says, who are Christian apologetics for? Now, that's kind of a weird question, I think, because you immediately think, well, it's for people who don't believe, right? Well, yeah, but I want to try to make an apologetic for apologetics, that apologetics is actually for all of you who are Christians in this. It's all of you in this room who are believers. It's for everybody. So some people make the mistake to say that, well, apologetics is only for people who are really smart or like to read or philosophy majors or whatever. And I would argue no to that. And the reason I'd argue no to that is because the scriptures are really clear to that. Peter doesn't suggest to you, he actually commands you to do this. This is your job. This is my job. And some people, it's easier for some people to do this. Some people it's harder. We don't like to be, maybe it's, I've been in this situation where I've been hesitant about saying something because I don't want to look stupid. What if they ask me a really hard question and I don't know the answer to that question? So back to that again, to just being honest takes so much pressure off to say, hey, I don't know the answer there. It's a great question. Yeah, this is for all of us. So really quick, there's, I think, four of these underneath this. Why is it for? How is it for all Christians? So number one, Christians should be able to explain why they have faith in Christ, to give a reason. So back to Peter's example again. Peter says, but in your heart set apart Christ as Lord. Always be prepared to give an answer. Do so with gentleness, right? This idea of hope, once again, Paul does this, Peter does this as well. They'll ground that in something that's real. So hope, back to Kelly's point earlier, apology sounds like we're saying we're sorry. We don't mean that in this case. Hope, sometimes in our culture, we hope for something like cross my fingers, close my eyes, I hope this happens. When the scriptures, that's never the case. Hope is always the absolute sure certainty that something's going to happen. And the reason they're so hopeful, they're so sure, is because it did happen. What is it? It's the resurrection. And Paul will ground this in the resurrection. So will Peter. this hope. So that's why, for example, Paul goes on to say in 1 Corinthians 15, he uses that great argument, that if-then argument. He tries to reduce it to an absurdity, and then he turns it around on itself. That this hope that we have is in the resurrection. And by the way, that's one of the topics that we'll get to in this. Can we know for sure that the resurrection happened? Why are we so certain about this? So we'll get to that. So it's always grounded not in a concept, but in a person. Number two, Christians should be able to critique unbiblical worldviews. Christians should be able to critique unbiblical worldviews. So Paul tells us in 2 Corinthians 10, for though we live in a world, we do not wage war on those that the world does. The weapons that we fight with are not weapons of the world. On the contrary, they're divine power to demolish strongholds. We demolish arguments of every pretense. This is part of you being a Christian, is to make argument, make claims of why, give a reason of why you believe, to demolish these things. John Calvin makes the argument, the reason you do apologetics, that he used this great term, is to close the mouths of the obstreperous, to shut them down. That's a big word, right? To close them down. Once again, not in an arrogant way, according to Peter, but actually in a loving, kind way, to say, hey, I hear what you're saying. Hey, have you actually thought about this before? So we'll get into some of those things. But yeah, that's the challenge. It's challenge these particular things. Number three, the Christians should use their minds and their intellect to glorify God. The Christians should use their minds and their intellects to glorify God. So Paul makes this reference, and once again, 2 Corinthians chapter 10, Jesus makes this assertion, right? To love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, strength. The mind part of it. By the way, we don't glorify in our mind. This is rationalism of the 18th century, where we thought we could figure everything out. We make our minds and our intellect our gods. That's not what's being talked about here. It's rather glorifying God with the mind that he's given you. That he's given you. And there's a huge difference between that, worshiping your mind versus worshiping the God who gave you that mind. And that becomes really distinct here. That's a part of following Jesus. Once again, it's not to win arguments. It's actually to win people. Number four, that Christians throughout history have used apologetics to the glory of God. That Christians throughout history have used this to glorify God. So I've got a few minutes left. I'm going to camp out here for a second. Okay? So I'd like for you to turn here to this passage really. This is Acts chapter 17. If you have a Bible, hopefully you do. This is Acts 17. This is a really famous, this is my favorite chapter in all the New Testament. Romans is my favorite book. Acts 17, favorite chapter. I had one of my best friends who did a tour of Italy, Rome, Greece. And it wasn't Brad, although Brad's a friend of mine. And he went there with his pastor friend of his, who's a friend of mine. And I, Acts 17. And I got this pastor friend of mine to go up to the Areopagus and to read this chapter. And my friend filmed it and sent me the film to it. It was pretty cool, right? So this is Acts 17. Which all of you, I'm assuming, are pretty familiar with. This is, I reason I stop here, this is Paul, I think, is probably one of his best places, this is my argument, where he's going to mix these things of apologetics and evangelism together. So I know you're familiar with this passage. This is, so Paul's been setting up churches in Thessalonica, Berea, he's done with Silas and Timothy, he leaves them behind, he goes to Athens, the intellectual, religious capital of the world. They had a god for everything. Right? Even they put everything, they built the Acropolis on the high place, and what the word Acropolis means, acro, high, polis, city, it's a high city. All the gods, they put it at the highest point. And Paul gets into the city, and he's stunned by what he sees. And he says this, or it says this. This is verse 16. Now, while Paul was waiting for Silas and Timothy at Athens, his spirit was provoked. It was moved. And what he saw, the city was full of idols. And so he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews, this is verse 17, and the devout persons in the marketplace, and every day those that happened to be there, and some of the Epicurean Stoic philosophers. See, only two groups of philosophers that are mentioned, systems, I think, that are in the New Testament. Epicureans thought that there was a perfect balance. There was no afterlife. There's only this life. So whatever feels good, you do it. It's their motto. So they had this perfect balance between pleasure and pain. Right? You had to have those balance, because if you got too much pleasure, it can turn into pain. They didn't want that. Right? If I'm really hungry and I ate pizza, that's pleasurable until I have 25 slices, and then that becomes painful. And then that's called the hedonistic paradox, where it switches on itself. Well, this is a group of philosophers. The other are the Stoics, and how they were also naturalists as well. They didn't believe there was an afterlife. So how do you deal with it? Well, you're Stoic, right? You don't let anything move you emotionally. You become very Stoic in that sense. So we have these two systems at work here. And every day, those happened to be there, and some of the Epicurean Stoic philosophers, and conversed with him, and some of them said, who's this babbler? The word here is, who's the seed picker? And what does that mean? Well, they would think of Paul as kind of this low, wrong, intellectual nobody, who's like a bird coming along and picking up seeds, different seeds off the ground. There's no system here. They have never heard anything crazy like this. This is a God they've never heard of. And now we're talking about a son of God. How can a God have a son? This is crazy to them. And so some of them said, who's this babbler? And others seems to be a preacher of foreign deities. And yet, look at what he does. He says that he was there preaching of Jesus and the resurrection. And they took him and brought him to the Areopagus. So it's this temple, actually it's this rock that juts out from the Parthenon that was there. This is where Socrates was tried. This is where they would have their kind of tribunal. This is where the court systems were. And it looks out over the city of Athens. And they bring Paul there to question him on these things. And they say to him, verse 24, you bring some really strange things to our ears. We wish to know them before what these things mean. And all the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there spent their time. That's all they did, is talk about these things, new things. Verse 22, and Paul, standing in the midst of the Areopagus, said, men of Athens, I perceive that in every way you're very religious. For as I passed along, I observed the object of your worship. I also found an altar to the inscription to an unknown god. 4 centuries earlier, there'd been a plague in Athens, and they didn't know how to get rid of it. And they had all these idols set up in Athens, to Ares, to Athena. And so this poet named Epimenides had this great idea. You try to appease the gods. So you get a group of black sheep, you get a group of white sheep, you send all the sheep out. And wherever the sheep would lie down, you'd sacrifice that sheep to that god, trying to appease that god to get rid of this plague. And wherever the sheep would lie down, where there's no idol, they would construct an idol, and they didn't know the name of it, so it's to an unknown god. This was their mindset. And so Paul picks up on this really fast. And he says to the unknown God, what therefore you worship as unknown, I proclaim to you the God. One God, a monotheistic God, not a bunch of gods. Paul's automatically challenging them, who's God? And he says, there's actually one God who made the world and everything in it, being Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made by human hands, nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything. Second premise, Paul says this God is not made up of material things. If you've ever read the Iliad and the Odyssey of Homer, the gods are just like the people. They're the same. They're the same material. They're worse than people, actually. And Paul challenges them right at the onset. There's one God, and this God is immaterial. He's not made of the same stuff that we are. You can't serve him in a way because he doesn't act this way. Paul goes on further, and then he quotes Epimenides and another Greek poet, and he says this. This is verse 28, and I know I've skipped over a lot of this. He says, for in him, quote, we live, move, and have our being. And then Paul goes on to talk about the fact of the resurrection. So what does that mean? Paul takes on the three things of the Greek world, life, motion, being. And he says that what you've been trying to find and stumble your way through, they thought it was water at one time, where all things come from. They thought it was fire. They thought it was wind. They thought it was earth. They thought it was the quintessential element, which is this kind of ageless, boundless thing. And Paul says it's actually the resurrected Christ that you've been worshiping in ignorance. So Paul does this masterful job of kind of combining all these things, but he gets to Christ in this. This is the goal of apologetics. We can't maybe do it as good as Paul does, but it's get to the risen Savior. So last part, we're out of time. What types of apologetics are there? There's actually three types, and there's actually many of these, but three big ones. You can see this on your list. So there's what's called evidentialism, giving evidence. There's one called presuppositional. That's a huge word. To presuppose. So in presuppositionalism, you say you're going to presuppose that God exists and presuppose the Bible's true, and then we'll kind of argue from there. And there are branches of that. And then there's one called classical apologetics. So there's evidentialism, presuppositionalism, classical. And there are people that get all up in arms about which is better, and they fight it out. And we're going to actually use all three of those in some ways, especially next week. Okay? We'll hit those as well. You've been super patient. So if you have a question, I know I've put it right to the edge, so it's 10:14. I'm supposed to be done at 10:15. We've got 1 minute. Question? I know I went through that really fast. Let me really encourage you, if you want to write down a question, bring it up to me, give it to me. If you want to email me, my email is in the directory, my phone number if you want to call me as well. So next week we take on, so here's some of the topics, we take on the existence of God. Is there proof for the existence of God? How would you go about helping your kid, your son or your daughter work through something like that who's been challenged with that? The problem of evil. The reliability of the scriptures. The resurrection. Different religions. We'll take on, at least in some part, all these things as we go through this course as well.